Here is our brother Greg Ferry.
I'll let you flee. Well, I've never been accused of doing stuff the normal way, or the way that we normally like to do things. I want to preface this by saying I kind of have an apology for the content. The content isn't very pretty tonight, unfortunately. But I really do think that this is a very pressing issue. And, of course, you're looking at this. If you haven't heard what it's about, you're wondering what on earth it's about. You'll find out very shortly. Brother Stephen has mentioned this topic a few times in the last little while, and I really appreciate his frankness and his openness for doing that, because I think that, without a doubt, the truth is under siege. And I use that term carefully, because siege is exactly the definition, in my humble opinion. An act or process of surrounding and attacking a fortified place in such a way as to isolate it from help and supplies for the purpose of lessening the resistance of the defenders and thereby making capture possible. Of course, what we're talking about is the change in our society, particularly around the gay rights movement, or if you do a little research, and I've done way too much lately, the gay rights revolution is the way they're calling it now. And so this is a topic we don't talk about very much. I don't think many of us like to talk about it. It's really uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable, I can tell you right now, it's uncomfortable for me to talk about it. But I think it's really important we do talk about it, particularly when we have young children that are attending school, and we have grandchildren, we've got lots of children in the meeting, and they're facing issues that we never faced before when I was young. Personally, when I was young, you know, growing up in the 60s and onward, this was a completely different world. This world didn't exist. And if you're as old as me, or even older than me, you know what the world was like a few years ago. No one, and I mean no one, openly admitted being homosexual or whatever. It was considered a scandal. And you could lose your job over it. It destroyed careers, relationships. If it was found out, some people committed suicide over it when it was found out because it was such a scandal. That was 40 or 50 years ago. And that's not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. If you've looked at what's happened over the last few years in particular, and you've seen it for the younger people, they've only kind of known the last 15, 20 years. But we've seen it from 30 or 40 years, and I know everybody who's my age, a little bit younger and older, know that this change has been massive. I mean, as Christadelphians, we tend to, like when we're talking together, we tend to profess indignation at the way things are changing. And yet, largely, Christadelphians have been left untouched. But if you do a search on the internet, on the Google, you'll find that there are quite a few Christadelphians who profess to be gay or lesbian. And it's becoming prevalent, even within our own community. So it's something we have to be aware of, I think. So what we hope to do tonight is not so much address why it's wrong, because I think we're all agreed on why it's wrong, although we'll touch on it very briefly at the end. But what I kind of wanted to do is look at the history of why, of how we've gotten to this place, how society has gotten to this place, and the impacts upon society in general, but more importantly upon ourselves, our young people, the children that we're seeing going to school, that kind of thing. So I want to start right back at kind of the beginning, and of course, not the very beginning, but after World War II primarily, because that's when things started to really heat up with this movement. What's happened has been subtle sometimes, and it's been insidious, similar to the death of a thousand cuts. I know Brother Stephen and I were talking about this, and he came up with the analogy of the boiling frog, which we'll look at in a second. But the history of this has been significant. I just want to go through briefly the things that relate to Canada in general. Of course, it's much broader than this, and it pertains largely to Western countries, English-speaking countries, but Western countries in general. 1949, a noted homosexual by the name of Jim Egan calls for reforms against what he felt was discrimination. Nothing much happened until 1960, when the Bill of Rights of Canadians was introduced into Parliament, where it set the stage for changing the rights of Canadians. It didn't pertain to homosexuality back then, but it did lay the foundation for it. In the 1960s, the RCMP actually kept tabs on homosexuals and gays. They used to raid gay bars and stuff like that, and it was considered a pariah. So people hid in the shadows, and it was illegal at that time. And so in 1963, the RCMP Directorate of Security Intelligence, called the A3 unit, was there rooting out and removing homosexuals in government and law enforcement. So you couldn't be in government, you couldn't join the military, you couldn't be in the RCMP or in police forces if that was what you were. In 1964, though, in the mid-60s, of course, everybody knows that's the time of free love and all of that sort of thing. Obviously, this had a huge effect on society in general. And it started to invade Canada and the Western nations, primarily coming out from San Francisco and places like that, where there was a lot of liberality in the world, and particularly in this avenue. So in 64, you had the establishment of the first gay organization called ASK. 64 to 67, there was a lot of books, novels, literary works, magazine articles supporting homosexuality. 1968 was the first reform to the criminal code, liberalizing social issues including abortion, divorce, and homosexuality. So that's when things started to open up. And in 69, by the end of the 60s, Canada decriminalized homosexuality. So that's really the start of when things started to accelerate. In 70 was the first gay pride parade in New York City. 71 was the first gay public protest on Parliament Hill. In 72, Maclean's aired Coming Out, the first series about the LGBT issues. 73, the Canadian Gay Liberation Movement was launched. Still, though, the RCMP and others were cracking down on gay bars in Montreal, particularly before the Olympics in 76. There was still this big stigma around it, and yet you can see the sort of the thin edge of the wedge that's kind of prying into society. 78, the first LGBT theater was launched. And in 78 was when the artist in San Francisco, this man by the name of Gilbert Baker, introduced a rainbow flag as their symbol for their movement. And that's become an enduring symbol since then. It's been changed a little bit. If you look at the history of it, it's been changed. But they've basically pirated God's symbol for the new covenant as their symbol for their pride movement. That in itself is an apostasy when you think about it. In 82, Canada establishes its own constitution, which is important as well because it sets the foundation for rights again. In the early 80s, and that's not that long ago, there were still raids on gay bars. But then in the middle of the 80s, it started to become more mainstream in the press, like the first gay newspaper, the Body Politic. You'll note the significance of the political angle with this. And something really big as far as education was concerned. In 1985, there was a murder of a gay employee of the Toronto School District. And that gave way to implement now, from the school district itself, an anti-gay program. So Toronto was the first school district that implemented that kind of a program in the system. In 1986, the federal government outlaws discrimination against homosexuals. So there's the thicker edge of the wedge. You probably remember, many of us a little bit older remember Sven Robinson becoming Canada's first gay member of parliament in 88. There was a number of attacks on gays who started to politicize the movement then and really turn it into a sense of urgency. And so it became not just a few people speaking out, but there's a lot of activism, politically in the political sphere. 1991, Ottawa establishes the first LGBT police liaison committee, and you no longer saw the police and the pride movement at odds with each other. By 92, you're allowed to serve in the military, homosexuals were. And by 1994, Ontario proposed legislation for same-sex spousal benefits. So in that short period of time from the 60s to the 90s, a lot has changed. In 1995, there was a court ruling that Egan versus Canada, which said that you could not discriminate on sexual orientation any longer. And a little while later, the Toronto School District launches its first alternative school program for LGBT youth. Now, we're talking about youth in our schools, talking about not just turning a blind eye to it, but accommodating that. And we're not talking about an art class or something like that. We're talking about sexuality in this case, where the school district is now legitimizing this, as opposed to setting forth a kind of a moral standard. In 1996, the Canadian Human Rights Act prohibits discrimination against gays, and no longer could there be anything discriminatory around this issue. 1996 to 2000, lots and lots of gay public figures elected to political office. There's a whole slew of them in that time period. First Prime Minister became the Grand Marshal of a gay pride parade in 2001, Joe Clark. You also had in 2002... the Durham Catholic School Board ordered to allow openly gay student to bring the same-sex date to a prom. So now no longer can you even hold the view, an opposing view to this. You could be ordered to do it as part of law. And that's where it starts to get really scary, I think. 2005, the Toronto Chief of Police marches in a gay pride parade. So you can see a big distance from the 60s. To the 2000s. 2006, Montreal hosts the World Out Games, and I don't have to describe what that's about. 2007, 103.9 Proud FM, Canada's first LGBT radio station. 2010, Vancouver Olympics, the first Pride House for LGBT athletes. 2013, Bill C-279 passes officially extending all rights now beyond homosexuality and lesbianism to transgender and transsexual people. So that's just 4 years ago. So the two scary laws that have come about recently, I think, the ones that are actually seriously concerning is this one. This is a federal law, Bill C-16. It's an amendment to the Canadian Human Rights Act and the Criminal Code. And so this bill adds gender expression, and you can sort of figure out for yourself what this means, and identity as a protected ground to the Canadian Human Rights Act. The bill makes it illegal to deny services, employment, accommodation, and similar benefits to individuals based on their gender identity. That doesn't mean so a boy can identify with being a girl and can say that, and you can't discriminate against that, or gender expression within a federal regulated industry. So that's one significant thing. The law amends the criminal code by adding gender identity or expression to the definition of identifiable group in Section 318. Section 318 is the criminal code side of it, makes it a criminal offense to advocate or promote genocide, obviously. I mean, we wouldn't agree with that at all. Against members of an identifiable group, which now includes gender identity or gender expression. And most importantly, the amendment also makes it a criminal offense to incite or promote hatred because of gender identity or gender expression. And the law is wide there. What that means is promoting it in any way, shape, or form. And we know from working in school districts and other government agencies that you simply can't promote that kind of thing. You're not even allowed to express an opinion about these things. You can get into serious trouble for doing that. The one that's scary, though, I think, as far as parents are concerned, is Ontario Bill 89, which was just put into, which was just voted on, and is in effect right now, as of June, is the Support for Children, Youth, and Families Act. So they took the old Children Family Act and took it for support for children, etc. And it gives the province more power to seize children from families that oppose the LGBTQI now, as it's being called, and gender ideology agenda, and allows government agencies to effectively ban couples who disagree with that agenda from fostering or adopting children. So a Christadelphian who believes that homosexuality is wrong in Ontario effectively could not adopt or foster children if that became aware. It adds gender identity and gender expression as factors to be considered in the best interest of the child. So instead of the religious faith of the couple, you know, we believe a certain thing, that used to take precedence over the rights of other individuals. But as you can see in the last bullet, it deletes the religious faith in which the parents are raising the child as a factor to be considered and mandates child protection services, and they consider only the child's own creed or religion when assessing the best interests of the child. So these rights take precedence over religious beliefs now. So you can have a religious belief that this is wrong and you biblically believe it, not in a way that promotes hate, but just by having that belief, it puts parents at risk in Ontario now, to the point where, theoretically, although the law hasn't been tested yet, if you were somewhat vocal in the way you spoke, your child went to school and told the teacher, well, we don't believe in that, and, you know, we think homosexuality is a sin and things like that, that could land social services at your doorstep now, which I think is very, very scary indeed. So all of this has happened over a period of largely from the mid-60s until this year, essentially. And in my way of looking at it, it's been kind of subtle and it's been kind of insidious, similar to the death of a thousand cuts, or more appropriately like boiling a frog, as nasty as that sounds. We're going to look at it. Which is a really good analogy for this, I think. And I don't know if this is scientifically provable, but suppose you want to boil a frog. Although I'm really not sure why you would want to do that, but how would you do it if you were going to boil a frog? You could place the frog into a pot of hot water, and as soon as it feels the heat, it's going to jump out. That's the theory anyways. If you try and put it in a pot of boiling water, it'll leap out right away. So what do you do then? You put a pot of cool water on the stove, and then you add the frog. And the frog doesn't sense the danger. It's going to stay in the water. You turn on the burner on low heat and slowly start to heat the water. And as the water warms, the frog relaxes. For the frog, the warmth feels good. The water gets hotter. It acts like a steam bath. It kind of drains the energy away from the frog, and it deepens its relaxation. The frog starts to become sleepy, having less and less energy, while the water is getting hotter and hotter. By the time the frog realizes the danger, the water is beginning to boil, and now it's too late to do anything about it. In fact, you're dying, essentially. There's neither time or energy to do anything, and by this illustration, the frog perishes in the boiling water. Now, there's some fact to that, because frogs are ectotherms. They get their heat from external sources. They're called cold-blooded, but in fact, they don't have cold blood. It's just regulated by their environment. So there's some truth to this, essentially. Frogs can control their temperature with their bodies, and they can do all sorts of other things. But the illustration is an interesting one, I think. It's a good one, because the change is so gradual, because they can adjust their temperature to the rising water temperature. It's too late when they finally realize that they're being boiled to death. It's a kind of a gruesome illustration, really, but it's appropriate. The changes to same-sex rights in Canada have been constant and gradual since World War II, and it's only now, I think, that we're really starting to see that society, and most importantly, the threat to true biblical principles, is being boiled to death. It really is. I used to think that the biggest threat we had was lethargy, like, you know, living in a society where we were free to do whatever we wanted. And, you know, unlike maybe in the time of the protesters, where you were always under threat of attack or the things that the Catholic Church was doing, perhaps, that was bad. This is also bad, too, when you think about it. I mean, for those of us who are a bit older, who have raised our children and now seeing our grandchildren being raised, it's scary. It really is scary to see the impact of these laws and these rights. The worst part of it is, I think, though, is that they're nowhere near finished with looking for additional rights and freedoms. They've just gotten started. And now that they're getting more power all the time, it's getting really serious. So just in summary, in 1996, the Canadian Human Rights Act was amended to specifically include sexual orientation as one of the prohibited grounds of discrimination. The Human Rights Commission gives detailed information about human rights and sexual orientation, particularly around complaints. If you've offended somebody, a complaint could easily be raised against you. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms expressly states equality for all and includes sexual orientation. Parliament passed Bill C-23, which gives same-sex couples the same social and tax benefits as heterosexuals in common law relationships. Civil Marriage Act of 2005 gives same-sex couples the right to be married anywhere in Canada. It can't be prevented. And in fact, some churches have had it foisted upon them because somebody wanted to be married in that particular church, even though they didn't agree with it. They may have had to give up the ability to actually marry their own members because of this. Sexual orientation cannot be discriminated against, and violations are punished by law. So the whole end result of this is that Canada is an incredibly tolerant society. That's what Stephen and I were talking about. Canada accepts you regardless of your religion, your race, your national or ethnic origin, your color, your sex, your age, your physical or mental disability, or sexual orientation. Canada, interestingly enough, is tolerant, but it's not tolerant for differing views anymore. You try and express this view, the view that we're trying to express tonight publicly, you know, stand in the in UVic somewhere and proclaim this and see how tolerant Canada is to this kind of view. We could easily find ourselves afoul of the law. Our views on homosexuality could be turned into hate crimes and examples of religious intolerance. LGBTIQ activists continue to pressure all levels of government. And make no mistake about it, they are getting stronger and stronger and more aggressive all the time. Every category here that we're looking at of this LGBTQI is abhorrent to God. I mean, we believe that. It manifests the kind of unbridled sin that's typical of Sodom and Gomorrah. Instead of hiding in the shadows and being publicly shamed, not only not being heterosexual, is a source of pride today. That's why the symbol of their movement is pride. Not being normal is something to not be proud of anymore. Being abnormal or espousing to these things is considered a thing of great pride. You see it. Now, we don't see these things because we're not there usually. So just a little while ago, a few days, I think last weekend, Victoria had the Pride Day Parade of 2017. 45,000 people showed up, supposedly, to the Pride Parade. You can see examples of them. If you look closely at who's there, you'll see school marching bands. You will see local businesses represented, almost all the local businesses. that want to remain in business for the most part. Families, you'll see all kinds of children sitting down, little children with their parents figuring prominently, of course, attended by the whole LGBT community. You'll see the police, the military was represented there, the Navy had a marching band. There were school marching bands from all over Canada and Western USA, from Washington, Oregon, California. There was government dignitaries. In fact, it would be the rare, foolish in their terms, government dignitary who didn't show up. There were celebrities. The whole week, it was a week this year. It wasn't a day. It was a week-long event. It included music, boat cruises, eating, drinking, dancing, and, of course, the raising of the pride flag over City Hall. All these things were going on around us. We don't see them because we're not participating in them. But it's scary if we were to go down and see them. Here's a good example from Esquimalt High School. Love, pride, and joy. And dead in the middle of that picture is the school principal. I personally find that shocking, to tell you the truth, that the school principal would be front and center with this. And that's not the only example. There's lots of examples. Spectrum and other schools were represented for Pride Week. The thing that's really scary, I think, is that some leaders are notably absent from these things yet. I don't think you'll see Trump, or I don't think you would have seen Stephen Harper being the Grand Marshal of the Pride Parade. But you look at this, you can see Trudeau is front and center. He's there with his wife and his family, his two children, and I think it's pretty symbolic that the flag he's waving is the Canadian Pride flag. It's got a maple leaf in the center and the Pride flag on either side. That is a change. That's something you couldn't have conceived of in 1960-ish. I would never have believed that possible, that we would ever see that in my lifetime, for sure. But this is just, again, the thin edge of the wedge. Now that they have power, and now that they have the ear of people like the Prime Minister, there's no holding back anymore. The floodgates are completely open. And so governments at all levels, including the City of Victoria, the City of Toronto, Vancouver, they are out in full support. And sadly, it's not over yet. I mean, when you go to the government website, the federal government website, and look at what this says, and we won't read it all tonight, but it says very clearly that Canada is a staunch supporter of the human rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex persons at home and abroad. And it goes on to show how much support there is now for this movement. So all that's kind of terrifying in itself from my perspective, that not only is this no longer hidden or in the shadows, but the government is supporting it at every step of the way, from municipalities all the way up to the federal government. I think what's even more terrifying, though, is that it has been entering our curriculum for a long time. So the idea of sexual orientation, you can see from Toronto, has been around since the 90s, and it has been creeping into the curriculum bit by bit. But if you look at this, which is where the curriculum is being developed for sexual orientation in BC public schools, it says, SOGI is a collaboration of the BC Ministry of Education, BC Teachers Federation, UBC Faculty of Education, Out in Schools, ART Foundation, 9 school districts across BC, and local, national, and international LGBTQ community organizations. And this is what they are promoting in schools. Sexual orientation and gender identity. SOGI is a term used by the BC Human Rights Code to describe an area of prohibited discrimination. It is an inclusive term that encompasses all individuals, regardless of where they identify on the sexual orientation or gender identity spectrums, including lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, two-spirit, heterosexual, and cisgender. I have no idea what some of those even are. This is the part of the curriculum. And the mission statement of SOGI is every class in every school. And that's the terrifying part, I think. And if you look at the sexual education curriculum, it starts right in K, right in kindergarten, that our children, if they're in public schools, are being taught. That's so gay is not okay. Right in K to 1, they're teaching about family diversity. They're talking about gender identity in grades 2 to 3. And on it goes, questioning gender expectations. LGBTQ rights in grades 5 to 6. Gender stereotypes and bullying, and on it goes, right up until grade 12. It's being, as they say, their mission statement is every classroom, for every student, they want them to be taught this curriculum integrated with it. It's, to me, it's when you're facing small children who are, you're doing your level best to teach them about the things of the truth and giving them a really sound Bible knowledge. This is in opposition of everything we believe. It's really horrifying when you think about it. Terrifying from our point of view. So things have gotten really hot, and we didn't even see it coming, I think, for the most part. Certainly Lot could sympathize with us now. If Lot was living in our day and age, he would probably relate to this situation really well. In chapters 18 and 19 of Genesis, it records, we'll just go back and have a look at this quickly again. I know we don't need to review this too much, but just so it reinforces how important this is. Genesis chapter 18 and 19, if we were all hazy on it, in verse 20 it says of Genesis 18, "And the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, rather, I will go down and do these things." Verses 22 and 23, "And the men turned their faces from thence and went toward Sodom," the angels, "and Abraham stood yet before the Lord. And Abraham drew near and said, wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" Because, of course, the angels who came to see Abraham also knew that Lot and his family was in Sodom and Gomorrah, as we know. And, of course, Abraham did not want to see Lot destroyed with the rest of the cities in the valley. And, of course, Abraham knew what was going on down there, hence why he wanted Lot back up into the hilltop rather than in the well-watered land. Of course, when you go through the story, you know that there wasn't even 10 righteous people in Sodom. And when you get to Genesis chapter 19, it records the two angels disguised as human men visiting Sodom and Gomorrah. And Lot meets the angels in the city and urges them to stay at his house, because Lot knew exactly what would happen. This was a wicked, immoral, and a very dangerous place, a terrible place to raise a family when you think about it. Genesis 19, verses 4 to 5. "But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round about, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, where are the men which came into this night? Bring them out unto us that we may know them." In light of the passage, the most common response to the question, and if you do a lot more research, you'll find out that, of course, people who care, homosexuals, lesbians who care about being Christian, have an answer for all of these things. All the instances where homosexuality is talked about. But, of course, they're really lame answers, and they really don't describe what's actually going on here. This is probably one of the plainest parts of Scripture. The men of Sodom and Gomorrah wanted the two angels, who were disguised as men. It's biblical to say that this was one of the main reasons Sodom was destroyed, Sodom and Gomorrah. There were other reasons, of course. We know that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. And we know that from Ezekiel that the iniquity of thy sister Sodom was pride, obviously, and fullness of bread, abundance of idleness was in her and her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of poor and needy, and they were haughty, and they committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw good. So, obviously, the word, the text has, it wasn't the only reason Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed, but it was the primary reason Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed. The Hebrew word translated abomination refers to something that is morally disgusting. It's the same word used in Leviticus 18 and 22 that refers directly to homosexuality as an abomination. If you turn back into the New Testament, into Jude's letter, just a few verses before, few chapters before Revelation, verse 7, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication, going after strange flesh, and set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. The strange flesh there is the same term, basically. It's an abomination. It refers to homosexuality. It is the primary reason for the destruction of the cities in the valley, Sodom and Gomorrah being the two biggest ones. They really do try hard to explain away the biblical condemnations of homosexuality. It doesn't take much research. Just ask the Google and you'll get all kinds of really good information about it. One of them is that they felt that the main sin of Sodom was inhospitality. Well, the men of Sodom and Gomorrah were certainly being inhospitable, for sure, to the point of violence. There's nothing more inhospitable than the way they were intending to greet the two angels. But he destroyed them because of the sins that they were committing. And to this day, the area where Sodom and Gomorrah were remains a desolate wasteland. And they kind of serve as a powerful example of how God feels about sin in general, but specifically about the sin of homosexuality. Now, that probably wouldn't go over very well if I walked out the door and ran down the street. I'm sure that wouldn't go over very well at all. In the reading of Romans chapter 1, we're not going to study it because we don't have a lot of time. You can read it and study it for yourself, but it's so clear. It doesn't require any strong biblical knowledge even. Therefore, God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women, and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. This doesn't get any clearer than that, I don't think. They do their best to explain it away, but it's just so clear. You can't really explain it away. You can ignore it if you want, but you can't explain it away. So why is it so abhorrent? It goes back to the question, what is it that's so awful in God's mind that he would destroy, obliterate an area where this existed? Well, it's mentioned in the New Testament, obviously in Romans. It's mentioned in the Old Testament. It's not just homosexuality, obviously. It's sin in general. But God's law commanded, you shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. So he makes that abundantly clear. Neither shall you lie with any beast, neither shall any woman stand before a beast, etc., etc. These things are abominable. We don't like to read about them. We don't think that they exist, but they probably do. But the ones that are so evident to us are all around us. I mean, really all around us. It's also been suggested that the nations who inhabited Canaan before the children of Israel conquered the land, who practiced homosexuality and prostitution only in connection with heathenous sort of worship. And that's what this law was designed to do, to not mingle this kind of sin with worship. And yet that, again, is explaining away something that just isn't true. The sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was considered an abomination, Ezekiel 16 and 15. In fact, there's a term for it that comes out. It's called sodomy, hence the word Sodom. It's tended to come down through the ages as that widespread term to describe that relationship between two men or two women or however it is. In Judges 19, there's a similar incident where a visitor to Gibeah and Benjamin was threatened with homosexual abuse by the men of the city, who are described in Judges 19 as perverted men. The age of the judges was a time when everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. Those two incidents alone, both of them unconnected with the religious sort of practices of the day, show that homosexuality was rife, even in those days. Today, it's not just occasionally, it's rife throughout our society. It's never been totally removed, even in the golden age of David and Solomon. There were also sodomites in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nation which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel, 1 Kings 14 and 24. It just repeats this over and over again. The law confirmed that homosexuality is an abomination to God, but it also shows that it defiles those who practice it and the society which tolerates it, worse yet. So it's not just a matter of the people who are partaking of it, but the society that tolerates it and, in fact, supports it becomes an abomination to God. So abominable is it in God's sight that he commands the children of Israel at the bottom there, if a man also lie with mankind, as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. That's why homosexuality is an abomination to God. For it was God who ordained the relationships between his creatures. Animals were created for the service of man, as man was to have dominion over them. Genesis 1, verses 26 to 28. And when we saw, and we won't go into it tonight, but nowhere in the animal kingdom was there found a suitable companion for man. So when Adam was created, as we know, he was on his own. He was the caretaker, the husbandman of God's creation in the Garden of Eden. But there wasn't found a suitable companion for him. And that leads up to the principle of what this is all about from God's perspective. The woman, Eve, was specifically, and I think we can, those of us who are married with wives, wonderfully made to complement the man. And that was confirmed by Jesus himself when he said to the Pharisees of the day, he answered and said unto them, have you not read that which made them at the beginning, made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Now we know that it's not just the uniting, the union of a man and a woman, for a number of reasons. We know, in fact, if you look at this scientifically, emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually, the woman doesn't mirror the man necessarily, but she perfectly complements him in every way, divinely appointed by God. There is this beautiful complementary relationship between the man and the woman. That's why we're physically different, why sometimes we think differently, why our emotions are different, why mothers are far better at caring for children than men, why men are stronger necessarily. All of these attributes were divinely appointed. And you can see it in biblical relationships like Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and Boaz and Ruth. And when you see it, and when it really works well, it is spiritual. It really is spiritual. The intended relationship between husbands and wives, raising children in a godly environment, is exactly what God intended. And he did it to show us a lesson about Christ and the bride as well. So there's a a spiritual lesson as well. He forbade sexual relationships between members of the same sex. He forbade promiscuity, asking that his children form one-flesh partnerships, a symbiotic relationship that exists nowhere else, one man with one woman. And he also recognized that animals could not provide the kind of companionship which people need, which men need in particular, Adam needed. It explains that spiritual element that's involved in the partnership that can only be found in one relationship. That's in a loving relationship between a man and a woman in God. So it's really important, I think, that we have that background, because we could easily be misconstrued as saying we hate the people who are doing this. We don't necessarily hate the people who are doing this. We hate the sin of it, and we wish there was some way we could convince them of the error of their ways, because the Bible certainly would have us do that. The Bible expresses really clearly that that kind of relationship, that homosexual behavior, is against nature. In other words, our bodies are not made for it. They were never intended for it. And you can see that. It's so plain. It's so plain. I mean, you could see all of the diseases which come as a result of those kind of relationships. HIV/AIDS is a direct result of those kinds of relationships. I think it's God's judgment upon that promiscuity, upon that changing of the relationship that God intended. So to break God's law of human relations carries really serious potential consequences. So from the Genesis account of the creation of man and woman and God's comment on their relationship, to commit any of these acts contrary to what God intended is to say that God was wrong in the beginning to make the arrangements he did. So those who proclaim it as being right and correct and we should embrace it are directly opposing what God intended. And they're doing it in the face of God. When Adam and Eve disobeyed God's command and ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they sinned and they suffered the consequences. Genesis 3. They deceived themselves. They disdained God's godly appointments. And we shouldn't be surprised at the punishment under God's law for disobeying God's arrangements for human relationships is death. That's the way it would have been meted out in the Old Testament, essentially. When we consider the way that God intended it, though, the wonder and beauty of what God has done and the spiritual intent behind the union of a man and a woman, it is absolutely evident as to what God was doing and how marvelous his design is. It speaks not only of a godly relationship between a man and a woman, as we know, but the spiritual lessons we learn and understand are so profound. These are just a very short list of the relationship that God gives us. It provides so much that those other relationships cannot hope to provide. A marriage in God provides a foundation for a new family and raising of godly children. So a seed to carry on the learning of the Bible, the teaching of the Bible, to carry on a new family afterwards. It's providing a partner for life in God, a true oneness that doesn't exist anywhere else. You have two people who are now committed to each other for life. Someone to share all of life's joys and sorrows. Someone you can be completely open with and honest with, even though they might swat you occasionally if you are naughty. But someone who comes to think just like you, and I can say that happens an awful lot the longer you're married. My wife often says stuff that I'm thinking and vice versa. The fact that men and women are divinely designed by God to complement and support each other perfectly. It is a marvelous union. Someone to love you regardless of your idiosyncrasies and weirdnesses. And I put that in for myself. So, but that's what it is. That's what it's all about. It's a godly union provides so many blessings that transcend all other relationships that exist in our society. I guess the long and short of it is, this is a difficult topic to breach. It's not one that I would normally like to do. It's particularly difficult for parents and for young people. But we live in a different age from when, you know, people like Uncle Mac and Auntie Sylvia and them were growing up before World War II and in through World War II. These were very different times from the time we live now. And I've seen some of that. And it's staggering and it's really scary. It really is scary to see how much it's changed. And in Canada, we like to think of ourselves as living in this fantastic land filled with opportunity. We sort of disdain other countries sometimes, but I really am afraid for where Canada is going. When our Prime Minister is standing, cheering, and waving that flag, it's shameful in the greatest sense to see him do that. He does not understand what he is doing. And I don't know whether it's political or whether he actually believes it. I think he does actually believe it. We live in a really promiscuous and sinful age where men and women do that which is right in their own eyes. It's gotten so bad, I think, in fact, that particularly in Western countries like Canada, that it's hard to talk about these things. That I think even ourselves, we're afraid to talk about them openly. In some places, you risk losing your job. You risk losing opportunities because there is now zero tolerance for any of these things. There used to be tolerance at one time when I was younger. This wouldn't have been tolerated back then. But now there's zero tolerance for speaking out against this. And it is kind of scary when you think about it. I really worry, not so much for ourselves anymore, like at our age, but for our young people and for our grandchildren at the world that they're growing up in. I can honestly see why lots of young Christadelphian couples are turning to homeschooling now. I know I would certainly revisit it. If I had young children in this day and age, knowing what the curriculum is going to be for our young children, it is scary at the kind of influence they're going to have. So it's not an easy time to be a Christadelphian. We think it's people don't care what we believe. I bet you they're going to start to care soon enough, I think. As we always say, we don't hate the sinner, but we hate the sin. In this case, we do our best to proclaim the word of God to any who would hear and heed its call. And we continue to do that. If there's one ray of hope, I think, in all of this, that this has got to be, surely this has got to be a signal for the soon return of the Lord Jesus Christ. If Sodom and Gomorrah were judged based on that, and the other things, the fullness of bread and their haughtiness, that really describes better than any time that I can think of our society today. So the only thing we can echo is, even come, Lord Jesus.